to a podcast about how to be unforgettable in your job search, an email lands that makes my breath halt. I stop short outside the fire station, my fingers tingling. I try to remember to breathe as I open this email with far too much hope flowing through my veins. It's from the foundation. Dear Josie, we're writing to let you know we received your application and have reviewed it. Do you have time for an interview sometime this week? All the best, Violet. The head of the foundation herself? This is almost too good to be true. Maybe this means I'm getting that extension. Maybe I can stay on at my branch with this. I hit reply, sending them the times I'm available. Then I float into the library. Maybe this long shot isn't such a long one after all. I walk toward the reference desk, past the trees decorated with ornaments of books, and smile at my coworkers.
What's that look for?
Eddie asks. I flutter my lashes. I have an interview, I say, then tell them the details. Eddie knocks fists with me, and Talia gives an approving nod. Would either of you be willing to do a mock interview with me to help me prep? Eddie taps his chin as if in deep thought.
Would you be willing to make those lavender chocolate chip cookies again?
Done, I say.
Then we'll help, he says. Right, Talia?
Of course we will. And until then, you've got some requests for your next 5 reads. It's business as usual, and maybe that's what my life can be. I'm on it, I say, and I keep myself occupied until it's time for a mid-morning break. I pop into the bathroom, texting Wes the good news on the way. Once I swing open the door, I nearly jump, raccoons perched on the edge of the sink, licking the faucet. Raccoon, you hate being normal, don't you? I head over and turn on the tap so he can drink from a light stream. When he's done, a reply from Wes lights up my screen.
Can we celebrate by skipping number 8?
Never.
Also, fuck yes.
Well, it hasn't happened yet. It's only an interview.
It's the first step.
That afternoon, my colleagues quiz me, and when I leave, another email lands. I landed an interview at a library in Petaluma early next week, too. It's about an hour away, but I don't even care. Everything feels possible. That night, after I've finished all my prep for tomorrow's Zoom interview with the foundation, I'm hanging out on Maeve's couch before we meet up with Fable for a paint and sip class, which doesn't count toward learning a new skill because we all mostly know how to paint and we definitely know how to sip. I'm plucking pistachios from their shells while Maeve layers tiny ocean-colored mosaic tiles onto an old tequila bottle. That's for the lamps she's been selling at farmers markets and night markets around the city. I was honestly worried I was going to need to call my mom, tuck my tail between my legs, and go home to Maine in January. Look for work from there, I say. But then, once those words come out, I want to flick a pistachio shell at myself. Actually, I might still have to do that. Of course that's what I'll have to do. A burst of panic curls inside me, rising higher. What am I thinking? There's no guarantee I'm getting this grant or even a job here. I should be realistic and assume I won't and figure I'll go home and live with my parents while I look for work like any other person my age these days, plan for any contingency. You're right. You might not get the job you want, Maeve says with supreme focus while she glues in the final tile. Then she looks up, but thinking positively harmed no one. Her attitude doesn't entirely settle my new worries, but it does distract me. Maeve, are you a closet optimist? Maybe I am, she says, dusting one palm against the other. Especially because I think we tell ourselves not to put our dreams out into the universe, like we're afraid they won't happen if we dare to whisper them. But that has nothing to do with whether they come true or not. Look at me. I sell lamps from old liquor bottles at the night market, and I told you 8 months ago I wanted to do that. I flash back to when I visited her in March while I was on spring break. Maeve loves painting, but she also loves making art. We visited the market she wanted to get a spot at for the lamps, and she pointed to it and said, I want that to be mine so badly. And then she did the work and landed the spot recently. And look at you now. Well, I'm still catering, but I'm getting closer to my dreams. And honestly, I think it's because I say them out loud. There's this media company that creates videos to inspire change, and one of the things they did a couple years ago was build a massive custom megaphone, like 20 feet long, and they set it up in Union Square with a sign that said, "Shout your dream to the world," and they recorded videos of people doing it all day long. And it's beautiful, she says, then pops up on the couch, tracks down the video, and shows it to me. In it, people of all shapes, sizes, ages, and colors shout through the megaphone to tell the city and the world what they long for. Love, a job that fulfills them, to live debt-free, to make art, to find the love of their life, to travel the world. Everything feels possible after I watch it. When it's done, Maeve says, "You should put your dreams out there." That sounds well beyond my comfort zone. So I say yes. The next day, I do the interview and it goes well. I'm prepared, engaged, and full of questions. So is Violet. That night, I gather Maeve, Fable, and Everly, and we head to the foot of the Golden Gate Bridge with a megaphone that Fable borrowed from the Renegades. It's not a 20-foot custom megaphone, but it'll get the job done. Everly didn't travel with the team this week. One of the guys in the PR department did. So she joins us. Fable waggles the megaphone. "Who volunteers as tribute?" My bold, outgoing Maeve grabs it first, then turns toward the Pacific Ocean, where the waves crash against the rocky shores, then stretch all the way to the edge of the inky night horizon. "The ocean can carry our dreams," she says, then squares her shoulders, brings the megaphone to her mouth, and shouts, "I want to make art that matters!" My heart swells, and I squeeze her arm in support. She gives it to Fable, who takes a deep breath, then goes next, muttering, "This is crazy, this is crazy, this is crazy." Then she says, "I want to launch my own jewelry line." The words echo across the sky and over the water, and I imagine the sea catching them in gratitude. Everly's next, and a sadness crosses her eyes, but a steadiness too, a certainty. "I want to live my best life, especially for those who can't." My heart clutches, and I flash back to what she said when we went grocery shopping. Had a friend. I drape an arm around her. Well, I'd never try to replace anyone. I hope I can be one of her friends in the present and into the future. She hands it to me. "Your turn." I take the red megaphone, then look to the stars, thinking of my aunt and the list she gave me. I wasn't sure what it meant for a while. Was it a connection to her? Was it a pathway through grief? Was it rules to live by? I'm not sure I'll ever know, and I need to be okay with that, to navigate the world without her guidance, but with her love as a compass. Maybe that's what the list was all about. I have a lot of dreams right now, but there's one dream I've had my whole entire life. I give it to the ocean with my voice. "I want to be happy." It feels like it might be coming true, but not because I put it out there, because I've been doing the work. Chapter 39, Dance Lessons, Josie. Dance practice might be the perfect time for me to ask Wes the next thing. Would you want to try long distance? If I can't get a job in time, and really the clock is ticking, would you want to try to stay together? I mean, it's not like I'm going to ask him if I can stay here and freeload while I look for work. That's not happening.
"Are we really doing this?"
Wes asks, groaning on the couch the next night, slouching deeper into it. He returned home late last night from his road trip, but barely has a break since he has a game tomorrow evening.
"I could play video games instead. That's kind of like dancing."
I laugh as I grab his hand, trying to tug him up. "Video games are not anything like dancing. How is it that you don't like dancing?"
"I'm bad at it."
I scoff. "Doubtful. You're an athlete."
"Yeah, and hockey is not ice dancing."
"It's not creating a charcuterie board either, and you still do that in your free time," I tease.
"Seriously, dancing is like the opposite of hockey."
"You're an athlete. You know how to move your body."
"In bed and on the ice,"
he says, then pulls me onto his lap.
"Speaking of the first one, maybe dancing is a euphemism for sex. See? We've already crossed it off 10 million times.
He's picking up my fine art of exaggeration, but he's wrong here. I reach for the chain around his neck and fiddle with it. You got sex from the list, the first one, and number 8 is dance in the park. Pretty sure my aunt didn't want me to bang a dude in the park.
I don't know. She sounds like she was pretty cool.
She was. You tossed me over your shoulder and carried me into the improv theater. Don't make me do that to you now. Begrudgingly, he lets me pull him up from the couch. I pat his firm chest, eager to move on to our practice. But you know how you said, I got you then? Well, I've got you now. I studied all the little foot drawings on a How to Dance page.
You did?
He asks, brow furrowed, then he shakes his head.
What am I saying? Of course you did. That's so on brand.
I head to his record player, put on a Frank Sinatra tune, then turn around. With a resigned sigh, Wes strides over to me.
I'm only doing this because it's you,
he says. Good enough reason for me, I say, especially since it gives me the confidence that now might be the right time. He loops his arms around my neck, and as the old standard plays, we practice to dance in the park.
Soon we'll cross off 3 more things,
he says as he brings me closer. His tone is wistful. Maybe this is the time to bring it up. We will, I say, then offer hopefully. But maybe we can start a new list. Like when we're apart, something that'll help keep us together.
Yeah, maybe.
Except that's weirdly non-committal from him, especially since he turns silent as we sway. My radar beeps. I might be wrong. Maybe now isn't the best time to say, do you want to try long distance if I can't find a job? My heart beats faster in worry as the silence extends. I should really try not to read into the silence. I try to just enjoy dance practice in the living room with him, but he seemed a little off since he returned home. 3 losses in a row will do that to you, though. Maybe that's what his mood is about. What if he wants to talk? Hey, is your dad pressuring you? I ask, a subtle way of saying, is hockey stressing you out? He huffs out a breath.
Yes, always. But he's also pressuring me about coming to Christmas at Frida's house in Sonoma. She's having some big party with her friends, and it sounds like hell.
Can you get out of it?
Easily. All I have to do is tell him I want to work out more, or do more yoga, or meet with a performance coach, or get in some extra ice time.
He says it flatly, not like it's a clever way to avoid the visit, which it is, but more like he wishes he didn't have to devise an excuse.
Besides, we only have a couple days off anyway.
Did he sidestep the question about pressure? I think he did, but the answer still came through loud and clear. Do you usually spend the holidays with your dad?
Him or mom. She's still traveling with her husband, but I've gone to see her in Colorado a few times in the past. It's weird, being an adult and going home for Christmas,
he says, and maybe Wes is just contemplative tonight. Mine are coming here for the holidays, to see Christian and Liv and the babies, of course. I say, foregoing my plans for now, since the time doesn't seem right. But I know what you mean. I feel lost in time when I go home. I lived at my parents' house during the summers when I was getting my master's, and then right up until I moved out here, and I just felt like, am I a kid or an adult? But maybe this is a way to broach the topic subtly? I really don't want to go home if I don't get a job here. That seems to snap his focus back to me. He gives me a steady look.
You'll get one.
Time is running out, though. But I don't say that. I say nothing because I don't trust myself not to say how I feel.
Will you go home?
He asks finally.
If you don't get one.
Why are you asking? Where do you want me to go? What should I do? I say none of that, though. I don't know. But maybe it'll be fine if I do. They hardly noticed me growing up. I got used to it. There are benefits to being the invisible child, I say, trying to lighten the mood. I half expect him to say, I see you, but he turns quiet again as the song ends. Are you thinking about how much you hate dancing? I ask. He drags a hand roughly through his hair.
No, just thinking about the game tomorrow. Sorry, I'm not the best company tonight.
It's okay. I let my arms fall from his shoulders and take his hand, leading him back to the couch again. What's wrong? Another hard sigh, another hand through his hair.
It's New York. We're playing them again, and that last game was rough. The last week has been rough. I want to do my best. I don't think I have been lately.
I hate that he's hurting. I hate that he's beating himself up. You will, I say, squeezing his hand, but when his phone buzzes on the table, he tenses, peering at the screen. His father's name flashes across it. He usually ignores his dad when we're together, but this time he grabs it, reads, replies, then puts it down.
He's just telling me stuff about the game. He'll be there.
Oh, nerves whip through me. Should I not go? Then another question swoops down. Does he know about me? With a guilty look, Wes shakes his head.
No.
For the first time, I feel like we're out of step.
Chapter 40. A Terrible Boyfriend. Wesley. The crowd roars deep in the second period the next night, barking like dogs, the rallying cry for the Sea Dogs. But I block it out and focus on the thumping of my own pulse. Hell, it's all I want to hear. If I listen any harder, I'll hear that fucking voice of doubt again. You don't belong in the first line. I grit my teeth as I skate hard toward New York's goal alongside Christian. But when Carlson swarms him trying to strip the puck, Christian flips it my way. I lunge for it, the stick connecting solidly. Since I've got an opening, I slam it to the net. But instead of flying into the twine, the puck misses by inches. Frustration boils inside me. It's not the first time it's happened tonight. I skate behind the net, and as I'm racing the other way, Carlson catches up, getting too close. First line pressure getting to you? It's hard when you suck, isn't it, Bryant? I want to kill him. Instead, I skate furiously, the cold air stinging my cheeks as I try to block out the doubts and frustrations echoing in my mind. I try not to look at center ice either. Don't want to get distracted. By Josie, by my dad, by my own damn expectations haunting me every second. I'm grateful for the line change and try to calm my emotions when I'm on the bench. But during the next line shift, I miss another shot at the net, the puck sailing wide, and I curse under my breath. Carlson's right there again, bumping into me, taunting. I'd say better luck next time, but maybe better luck in the minors. He smirks, and it takes everything I have not to drop my gloves and pummel the asshole. His insults aren't even personal. It's just who he is. It's literally his job to talk trash, and it's mine to take it. When I hop over the boards to the end of the shift, I pull off my gloves and hurl them on the floor in front of me on the bench. And that's not like me either. I don't fling shit. Coach arches a brow more serious than I've ever seen him. Ah, hell. He leans in and whispers something to the assistant coach. My heart freezes. This is bad. This is really bad. And it's all my fault. By the time the game ends, my team pulls off a win, no thanks to me. I contributed zilch to it. When I trudge through the tunnel, I don't even look to the stands to find Josie. Can't fucking face her. Can't stand failing like this in front of her. When I reach the end of the tunnel, Coach is there in his suit and his game face. The snapshot of him would be titled ominous. A word, Bryant. A word is never good. He pulls me aside into his office, then glances at the clock on the wall, like he has to be somewhere. You're doing great, Bryant. But let's stick to the second line. You seemed more comfortable there. My chest caves in. My stomach sinks to the bottom of the earth. I knew it was coming, but that doesn't make it hurt any less. Yes, sir. We can talk more about it another time, he says. I need to do an interview. But what else is there to say? It's clear. When I leave his office, my dad is waiting for me in the corridor. I am not in the mood for him right now, not at all. Let's grab a bite after you work out, he says. Like I'd forget the post-game workout. Like I don't know what he wants to talk about either. Yep, I mutter. I head to the locker room, grab my phone and text Josie to tell her I can't introduce her to my dad tonight, and that I'll see her at home. I feel like such an ass. I stare at the message. I'm a terrible boyfriend. But I can't, I just can't. Just like I knew what Coach was up to, I know what's coming next from my dad. I brace myself for it as I strip off my uniform, shower, and change. Dad asks if I want to go to Sticks and Stones, but that's a bar frequented by my teammates. Don't need to get reamed in front of everyone, especially on a busy Friday night in December when the place will be packed. I say no, and we opt for a Thai restaurant on Fillmore that's open late. I order the chicken with vegetables and a papaya salad. No less than 10 seconds after the server leaves, Dad gives me his best, "I'm concerned" face. "You're distracted," he says, and his tone is kind, but I want to shove his words right back into his mouth. "You have been since that game against LA. I know all too well which one he means. That was the day I talked to Christian and told him I was seeing his sister. But that night when I played, I was up in my head about Josie staying in town or not. She was all I thought about when I was on the ice, and that is not like me. I've learned mental discipline. I've cultivated it over the years. Hell, Dad's paid for me to train my body and my mind. I don't get distracted. Ever. But the more I think about the future with her, the worse I play. I've just had a couple bad games this week," I grumble, then take a drink of my ice water. Dad nods a few times, thoughtfully. "Which happens when your mind is elsewhere. Like when that girl Anna broke it off with you last year." "That's not what happened," I snap. He gives me a placating look. "Wesley, it kind of did. There was that game against Boston, then one against Montreal." "Are you kidding me? He remembers when she dumped me and that I played for shit then?" "Don't go there," I warn. "Since I can handle a lot of his advice, I can absorb a ton of his input. But I do not want his advice about romance." He leans forward in the booth, his voice so calm, so opposite mine. "But we need to figure this out. Like I've said, this is a critical year." My jaw ticks. I've heard that 1,000 times. "And yet, I still don't want to talk to you about women," I bite out, surprising myself for standing up to him. I'm so glad I didn't introduce him to Josie. He would never understand the way I feel for her. He lifts his water, takes a drink, sets it down, smiles. Perhaps he's heard me and we're moving on from the topic of romance, but he's not a lawyer for nothing. "Level with me. Is this because of your roommate?" The fuck? How does he know? I never told him we were dating. "What are you talking about?" I ask with a sneer I can't hide. "It's not hard to figure out. I took a guess that you'd fallen for her," he says, then shrugs easily. "The evidence adds up. Looks like I was right." How smug can he possibly be? I grind my molars, but I don't say anything, because I have nothing to say to him about my love life. But he has plenty to say. "You need to work on your focus. Life is going to keep coming at you. Do you need a mental skills coach, a psychologist?" All he wants to do is hire people to improve me. No wonder I felt like I was hockey, hockey, hockey when I met Josie. Because that's all he ever wanted me to be. That's all he ever sees me as, a hockey player. But a voice whispers meanly in my ear, stirring up all my old fears. "Maybe there's a reason. It's the only thing you're good at. Except, what if you're not good at it after all?" "No," I say, answering him at last. He tilts his head, seeming confused momentarily. "No, what?" "No, I don't want you to hire anyone, okay? Coach already moved me back to the second line. It's done. Can we just eat in peace?" "But what about the roommate situation?" The implication is loud and clear. I clench my fists, take another deep breath, then one more. "I meant it. I do not want to talk to you about women." He takes it on the chin with a resigned nod. "Fair enough." I stick to my guns, shutting my mouth. But that means he drones on and on about hockey for the next 30 minutes, and I sit there and eat and take it. When I leave, I both want to talk to Josie and run from Josie. And I hate feeling this twisted and torn. Maybe I can get some sleep and sort it out in the morning. Curl up with her and fix it when the sun is up. But when I get home, she's not in my bed. And that feels like a kick in the balls.
Chapter 41. Kind of a lot. Josie. Wes said to presume a few weeks ago, but I can't presume tonight. I can't presume he wants me upstairs. I can't sleep either. That's the problem. I never have trouble sleeping, never. But tonight, I'm in my own room for the first time in more than a month. The lights are out, and I'm trying so hard to bring sweet dreams my way. But as soon as I hear him return to the house and head up the steps, I know he's looking for me. I know he's disappointed. Even if I feel him pulling away from me, have felt it since we danced in the living room last night, I don't want to be another thing that hurts him. I want to help him like he helped me the night we met. Besides, I've been trying to be brave. I've been trying to be bolder. I fling off the covers and push out of bed, pushing open the door right as he's stepping into the doorway. I flinch in surprise, then back up. Oh.
Hey.
That's it. A heavy syllable breathed into the night. He looks terrible. Devastated. What happened? Do you want to talk? Did your dad give you a hard time? He grits his teeth, then breathes out hard.
Yeah. He said I'm distracted. Coach said as much too when he moved me to the second line.
I'm sorry, I say, guilt lancing through me. This is my fault. Wes is distracted, and I know why. Still, I have to try to make him feel better. But that's where you started the season. It's not that bad, right? You know exactly what to do there, and you can keep working your way back. But that's the exact wrong thing to say to an athlete. A step back isn't fine. He's wired for excellence, not acceptance.
No, Josie. It's bad.
He says in a hard voice, correcting me sternly. I feel stupid all over again. I'm sorry. He frowns, apologies in his brown eyes now.
Shit, baby. I didn't mean to take it out on you.
He reaches for my face and cups my cheek. And it feels so good as he strokes my jaw, but it feels awful at the same time because it's an I'm sorry gesture. I'm sorry I'm about to hurt you.
I'm a wreck right now,
he says, his voice strained, full of potholes and self-loathing.
But it's not your fault.
Except, is it my fault? That's what I can't shake, the feeling that I'm to blame. Do you think you're distracted? By me and us and my job search and by what's going to happen, is it stressing you out? All the unknown? My chest aches horribly, but I have to ask these questions. He pauses for a long while. In that stretch of silence, his face is honest, brutal even, with the truth in his eyes. The truth is yes, we are a distraction. I am stressing him out. But stoic Wes takes over and erases the emotions on his face.
No.
That's a lie. He has another game coming up in 2 days, then another after Christmas. They're important games, especially after the last few rough ones. I could ask him what happens next for us. I could mention the long distance thing. I could say I want us to make this work. But what can I offer him right now that'll settle him? Nothing. I'm still in limbo. I don't know if I'm staying or leaving. But I know this. I'm not the one trying to play professional hockey in front of 20,000 people every other day, with media who breathe down my neck, fans who cheer and jeer me, and a father who gives me a hard time. I do know what that's like, though. I was raised with it. From the comfort of my books, I watched that world unfold as my parents focused on my superstar brother. Gave him every opportunity to succeed. They were right to channel their energy into him. Look where he is now, at the top of his game. Growing up, he was the plant that required a lot of water. Me? I'm the cactus after all. My family barely notices what I do, and really, it's okay. I've always had books and friends. I've always done a good job taking care of myself and getting out of the way. My aunt taught me to cook, to bake, to learn, to read. Most of all, she taught me to be independent. With a cold, stark certainty, I'm sure I have to do for Wesley what I did for my family growing up. Get out of the way. With a gentle smile, and I hope a caring one, I reach for his forearm, rub my hand along the dog and music notes. But what if you are too distracted by everything that's happening here? With me, I mean, I'm kind of a lot.
Don't say that,
he says, but it lacks his usual vigor, his usual bossiness. "I am," I insist. "The night you met me, I was locked out and half naked, and you saved me. The next time, I lost my short-term rental, and you saved me. Then you found my list, and you offered to do it with me." Emotions climb up my throat, tightening it in a chokehold, but I try to push past the tears stinging the backs of my eyes. "I'm a lot. You've given me a lot, but you need to leave something for yourself." His brow knits.
"What are you talking about?"
I roll my lips together, fighting off the waterworks, then I dig down and say, "Would it be easier if I finished the list on my own and give you a little time to refocus?" Time. It's the one thing we don't have. But right now, that doesn't matter. It doesn't matter because Wes is quiet again, chewing on that, perhaps. That's another sign I'm doing the right thing for him. Wes is quick and passionate. He doesn't mull things over. He doesn't stew. For the first time ever, he's stuck. The man is twisted in knots. I have to give him this lifeline. I throw him some more rope. "You didn't want to dance in the park anyway, and that's okay," I say gently, kindly. "The list is a lot, too. I could do it with my friends. I haven't done anything on it with them. Maybe I should." He breathes in deeply, nodding the tiniest amount, absorbing that. "And the cocktail mixing class," I say, exonerating him more. I wave a hand. "Let's do it another time." That's a futile promise because we don't have time. But he doesn't correct me, so I continue. "Right now, you should focus on hockey." He runs a hand down his face, closes his eyes, then breathes out. For a few seconds, I hope so damn hard he'll resist my overture. But when he opens his eyes, he grumbles.
"You're probably right."
My heart breaks, but I try to keep it together. What he doesn't say next is, "Let me hold you all night. Come to bed with me, or we'll figure it out together." Instead, he nods to my room and the bed I haven't slept in weeks.
"I should let you go to sleep."
What I hear is, "I should let you go." Chapter 42, The Step Around Skill. Josie. I've spent the last few weeks reading every blog post, watching every video, and gobbling up every article I can find on what to expect in your first pole class. But Everly also tells me to expect cardio and fun. I need the latter now more than ever as I tiptoe around the townhome on Sunday morning. I am quieter than I've ever been, and I use my morning personness to my advantage. I successfully avoided Wes yesterday by waking early and exploring the city, then hanging out with Eddie and his husband playing mini golf in the evening. Today, it will be even easier to avoid Wes since he has a game. Once again, I'm determined to escape before he wakes up. I'm dressed in leggings, a sports bra, a t-shirt, and a sweatshirt, and I've got knee pads and a water bottle in my canvas bag, right next to the blank book where I keep the list. I've even slipped my book charm necklace into a pocket in my bag. I have them both with me today, maybe because I need to feel close to my aunt. I walk quietly past the stairs, half expecting him to hear me, wholly wanting him to call out, "Let me drive you." What a foolish wish. But he loved to drive me wherever I needed in the city. He's an acts of service guy through and through. The house is painfully quiet. The emptiness tunnels through me as I pad to the door, carefully lift the latch, then grab my sneakers and take off. On the porch, I lace up my shoes quickly, ignoring the onslaught of feelings I don't want to feel. I manage to make it down the front steps before my throat hitches. Tears prick my eyes, but I suck in a breath. I'm wearing my fake lashes to pull classes so these tears can fuck off. Down the street, I catch the bus and head to Russian Hill to a dance studio that Everly likes. But even though I've done my homework, no amount of prep can gird you to walk into a class when your heart is shattered and you're pretending you're fine. Everything hurts. Everything reminds me of him. Even this. I would have shared the story of this class with him, told him about it, taken some pics. He would have eaten up every detail.
but I guess he can't have love and hockey, so I go in alone. But I'm not truly alone. Everly's a welcome sight. She's dressed in a long-sleeved shirt, which surprises me, but maybe she doesn't sweat like me. She's stretching in front of the mirrored wall in the brightly lit studio, and she beams when she sees me. You made it! I don't back down, I say, even though I tried to wiggle out of improv. But I soldiered on and did it. Come to think of it, I haven't backed out of anything on the list. And damn it, man in my life or not, I'm going to finish it. In fact, I don't need to go to a cocktail mixing class for number 7, explore a new skill. I'm living number 7 right now with my friends. The awareness hits me all at once, and I smile like a giddy fool, tugging on Everly's hand, pulling her to the cubbies in the corner of the studio as Maeve strides in. Fable couldn't make it. She had to do some Christmas shopping with her sister. I have this list from my aunt, like a bucket list, top 10 things I never regretted, I tell Everly. Her eyes light up. You do? That's seriously cool. And one of the items is explore a new skill. I motion for Maeve to join our huddle, and gamely, she hustles over. I was going to do number 7 with Wes, but I want to do this one with you two. Can this be explore a new skill for my bucket list of no regrets? As if you have to ask, Maeve says, then tilts her head, and I know what she's thinking. What changed with Wes, and why now? I swallow down more tears. I'll tell you later. For now, it's time to dance. 10 minutes later, I'm walking around the pole. That's it, walking. But as Kyla, the instructor, says, it's harder to walk than you might think. You want to make space between the pole and your body, and then you can do the step around. She explains that basic move, then asks Everly to demonstrate. In no time, my new friend swinging around her pole like a goddess, all muscles and badass attitude, shiny ponytail swishing down her back. Now, let's try the step around, Kyla says to the rest of us. Sounds easy, and looks easy too, but when I try the basic move, gripping the pole with my right arm, then rising up on my toes so I can stretch out my left leg to the side, I'm not sure I can move around the pole without falling on my ass. But then, so what if I fall? I stop thinking and I do, swinging around it, and I manage a quarter turn. Actually, that was more like an eighth of a turn, but I'm stupidly excited over this most minor accomplishment, and so is the teacher. Great start, Kyla says to me with genuine enthusiasm. Those words burrow into my aching, hollow heart. Great start. As Maeve attempts her step around like she's jumping off a cliff, since that's how Maeve lives life, I think of the list, of the other night by the Golden Gate Bridge, of my dreams. They don't have to be anchored to a man. Just like that, I can see a new future, one I haven't planned for or prepped for or researched. But maybe that's part of me exploring new skills. I don't mean this skill. I mean another one. I'm learning to leap.
Chapter 43. A Damn Fine Bagel. Wesley. Funny how I never noticed the room under the staircase much before. I barely paid attention to it for the first several months I lived here. Now it's all I see. It taunts me. It lures me. And I have to fight the pull. I give her space. I avoid her. I stay upstairs when she's downstairs. I don't know what to say or do when I see her. I guess this is why there's a roomy rule in the first place. Because it is complicated when you cross it. When things go south, like they did 2 nights ago, you're still stuck together, walking uncomfortably around each other. But a little while after she leaves on Sunday, I'm pretty sure she's going to that pole class with her friends, and I hate that she's not going to be sending me a picture. I get out of bed, get dressed, and head downstairs to make my way to morning skate. The problem is, that door to her room, it's halfway open. I stop in the entrance to it, press my palm against the white wood of the door lightly till it creaks open. I look inside. My chest aches at the signs of Josie. The white sweatshirt I bought her the night we met is tossed on the bed. The black scarf she left behind hangs from the closet door. Pillows are arranged in a whole new way on the window seat. I lift my nose in the air and draw a big inhale. I can smell the remnants of her cinnamon scent. On the bureau, there's a pad of blue paper, like the one she used to leave me notes on. My chest hollows and I press my fingers against my temple. I wish I had the courage to grab that paper and write her a note. But what would I even say? I'm sorry. I miss you. I'm a mess. That's all true, and she knows all that. So I tear myself away from her room, trudge to the kitchen and yank open the fridge. But it all looks so boring. I flip my middle finger at the prepared food, then trudge down to the garage, peel out quickly, and stop at a nearby bagel shop for a pineapple smoothie and a toasted sesame bagel. That's a damn fine breakfast. An hour later, I'm dead focused on the rink during morning skate, passing to Asher, Hugo, and Alexei. Shooting on Max, flicking the puck under a low bar, then racing behind the net and slapping the disc under it again and again. Practice makes perfect. Muscle memory. Discipline. Midway through, coach blows the whistle and calls me over.
Bryant, why don't you get out there with Winters and Weston?
He gestures to the other end of the rink. Naturally, Christian is here since he never misses practice. Chase is too. But that's first line, I point out so helpfully, like coach doesn't know the intricacies of his lineup.
I'm aware. You've got great chemistry with the second line. Chemistry doesn't come overnight on the hockey rink. You've got to get out there and work with them.
He points to me, and I turn back around, flying toward the other two guys. I'm not sure what to make of this direction, but I am sure it's not my place to question it. I run the drills with Christian and Chase until we're done 30 minutes later. In the locker room, Asher tips his chin toward me as he laces his shoes.
You want to grab some dinner after the game tonight?
Maybe, I say with a shrug. He stares me down.
Dude, what's with you? You're not your usual self.
I could deny it, but instead I scratch my jaw, shrug, and say heavily, yeah, I know. He seems to give that some thought, nodding a few times, but when we leave a couple minutes later, he claps me on the shoulder in the corridor.
Remember, it's a game. Just have fun. That's what you gotta do at the end of the day.
Then he offers me a fist for knocking. Since you don't leave a teammate hanging, I knock back. Asher has the right attitude, he always has. He has an easy way about him and a carefree attitude, and it works. My stomach twists, and I don't normally put myself out there, but impulsively I ask, how do I do that?
Stop trying to be perfect. Just get out there and play.
It's good advice, truly it is. After I go home and nap in the deathly quiet house where I miss Josie more by the hour, I return to the rink. I do my best to focus on just that. Fun. Hockey used to be fun once upon a time. Then it became work. Then it became pressure. Then it became performance. Then it became the relentless pursuit of perfection. But during the last few months, I've learned how to have fun again. Thanks to Josie, the woman I let go.
Chapter 44, A Great Start. Josie. Everly was right. Pole class is cardio, and I'm a sweat-soaked monster when we leave. But I don't care as we dart into a nearby cafe for lunch. After we order, I clear my throat and return to the great start. So I was thinking, I really do want to stay here, and I don't have a job, and it might take me a while to get one, but I've saved up in the last few months because I didn't have to pay rent. Everly's expression is thoughtful, while Maeve's is dead curious. Both wait for me to keep going, though. It's okay to sit with discomfort. It's okay to do the hard thing. And I want to stay here, even if... But my voice catches, and all my emotions well up into my throat. Oh, sweetie, what happened? Everly says, rubbing my shoulder like she's the big sister I don't have. I fight off the onslaught of emotions and say through tight lips, I'm not sure it's going to work out with Wes. He's blaming himself for his bad games. Everly sighs. Hockey players are the worst. I'm sorry, Josie, Maeve says. Men sometimes suck. Yeah, I say with a sigh, but I also didn't want to get in his way. I sort of offered to take a step back. Maeve blinks, her brow furrowing. What? I don't want to reveal too much of the private conversation the other night or expose Wesley's fears. I keep it simple, saying, I was worried he was too distracted by me, so I asked if it would be helpful if I finished the list on my own and if we took a step back. And he agreed? Everly asks, arching a brow. Yes, he did, I say. Hmm, she says, seeming to chew on that. What's that for? It's great and all that you're being respectful, but it sounds like you're both being too respectful, she offers. It's like a slap, but a friendly one, if a slap can be friendly. Still, I reel a bit and push back. I'm not going to force him to stay with me when he's in a funk. I get it, she says, then leans closer, her eyes shrewd, but her tone kind. But maybe he needs you to fight for him. I freeze. I hadn't thought of that before. Does Wesley need that from me? I thought I was doing the right thing, being respectful and all for his job, but did I back off when I should have forged forward? It's not her fault, Maeve points out, squeezing my shoulder protectively. I know that. Wesley probably knows that. Everly locks eyes with me, fixing me with a tough stare. But only you know if you should fight for him. Or if he should fight for her, Maeve suggests. Everly exhales for a long beat, then perhaps shifts some. Maybe you both need to fight for each other. Maybe we do. I nod, but I'm not entirely sure I'm ready yet. There's something else I need to do first. Fight for myself. Grabbing a napkin, I swipe it across the table to clean up any crumbs, then take the list out of my bag, spreading it out for my friends to see. I might as well cross off number 6. I've been doing it for the last few weeks, and I'll keep doing it. I draw a line through volunteer. Then I say to the women at the table, let's cross off number 7. I say, then add, together. It feels right to do this without Wes, just like I'll do the rest myself. Then I'll be ready. After all, that's what number 10 is all about. But I have to do number 8 and 9 first, and I have to do them alone. I hand Maeve the pen. Maeve starts the strike through, crossing out explore. Everly goes next, marking off anew. It's my turn, and I finish the line. I look down at the list that's nearly complete, from the one-night stand to overcoming a fear to making a new friend. We've done so many other things, too, like eating dessert for breakfast, taking pictures, volunteering, and now this one with my friends, exploring a new skill. There are only a few more left, and I read those, though I know them by heart. 8, dance in the park. 9, celebrate your goodbyes. After folding the list up carefully, I put it back in the bag, fighting off this tug in my chest, this pull toward Wesley. And I fight for myself a little more, a little harder. Could I stay with one of you while I look for a job? Of course, they both say in unison. I don't even care about the kid and Maeve's couch, but when Everly says she has a guest room, I'm so there. Maybe I should even move out tomorrow after my job interview in Petaluma.
Chapter 45. He can learn. Wesley. When I hit the ice that night, Asher's advice repeats in my head like the chorus to your favorite song, an Arctic Monkeys tune or a Youngblood number. Something anthemic, a love song you can't get out of your head. Have fun. As I play hockey that night, I try to have a good time. And a funny thing happens. I do. After the game, I'm in the weight room, like usual. Not because I have to be, but because I want to. It might have been my dad's idea originally, but the fact is, I like the way these post-game workouts make me feel. Strong, resilient, ready. In my body and my mind. As I'm doing deadlifts, Christian strides in. Hey, I say. He gives me a chin nod and starts racking the bar on the bench press. Been meaning to ask, he says, then clears his throat. Do you want to come over for Christmas? Josie and everyone will be there. I stop midway, barbell in hands. Things I didn't have on my bingo card? A Christmas invite from the captain. As I finish the lift, I grunt out, I'm not sure. He narrows his eyes, looking me up and down like I've given the wrong answer in class. You broke it off with my sister? I blink. Am I that transparent? No. But I say it defensively and frankly in the shape of an obvious lie. It's just, I've had some bad games, as you know, and she offered to give me space. Christian stares at me for a long, shocked beat. And you took it? You, the guy who came barreling into my house a few weeks ago, just took her offer for space? When he puts it like that. I did, I say, wincing, because I'm pretty sure that was the wrong answer again. I did the wrong thing. I fucked up big time. He shakes his head in disgust. Dude, I don't leave my wife when I have a bad game. You had a couple of bad games. Get your shit together. It said authoritatively, the captain in charge. And the captain is right. But what am I supposed to do to fix this? Both the hockey and the romance. I swallow past my discomfort and ask a hard question. It's one I've only ever asked of my dad before. What do you do when you have a bad game? His expression is thoughtful, open, as he says, I talk to a teammate, or I see the athletic trainer, or I speak with a coach. I ask for help. He sits on the bench and fixes me with a no-nonsense stare. You could come to me. He's right. My gut churns with regret. But the world only spins forward, so I step past my discomfort, and I do one of the hardest things I've ever done on the team. Can you help me? Christian smiles. I thought you'd never ask. We chat for a good long time, and when I get home, I peer longingly down the hall, checking for a sliver of light from Josie's room. But it's dark, so I go upstairs and dictate his advice in a note on my phone. Then I visualize tomorrow morning when I can start over. Around 8 a.m., when I hear Josie moving around, I do the same. I fly out of bed, brush my teeth, and throw on shorts and a sweatshirt. I hustle downstairs. I'm dressed and ready to take her to work, at her fucking service. I'm buoyed by Christian's advice. Set short-term goals, not long-term ones. Focus on the positive and lean on your teammates. When I find her in the kitchen, she's gathering her things and wearing a black pencil skirt and a soft pink sweater. She looks like the polished, put-together young librarian she is. I want to pull her close and run my fingers through her hair and tell her I'm an ass. But I focus on her needs first. Can I give you a ride to work? She flashes me a soft smile and shakes her head.
I'm going to Petaluma.
That throws me for a loop. You are?
Yes, I have a job interview. Talia gave me the morning off so I could focus on it, and since it's kind of far.
Right. She mentioned the interview. I didn't realize it was today. Because you've barely been talking to her, you dumbass. That's huge, I say, my heart racing 5 steps ahead, hoping this means she can stay. But do I even have the right to ask her that anymore? I need to fix things first.
And I should really go, because there are about 3 buses I have to catch. At least it's only 2 buses back to work, though.
She says before I can get another word in. Nope. No way am I letting her catch a trio of buses on the way up alone. I'll drive you. I want to. I can, I say, playing the bossy card. She shakes her head.
Actually, I kind of want to do this on my own,
she says, then gives me an apologetic smile.
I should go.
She pauses, frowning, looking like she wants to say something more. After a beat, she exhales.
For what it's worth, I think you're too hard on yourself. I really do. And there are a ton of things I want to say.
Her voice is laced with emotion, but her gaze strays to the clock on the wall even as her eyes shine.
I have to go.
But what do you have to say? The desire to hear those ton of things claws at me, like a wild beast let loose in my chest. But I have to give her space. She heads to the door and I watch her leave, strangely impressed by her gumption and her guts. I want to chase after her. I want to insist she lets me drive her. But I flash back to what she said the other night, that she was a lot. to how she felt I'd kept saving her like I did on the first night. Then less than a week later. I get it. Some things you have to do on your own. You have to save yourself. She closes the door and leaves. I wander aimlessly, a lost kid at the zoo. But a few minutes later, my phone rings. Maybe it's her. Maybe she's changed her mind. Maybe I can go pick her up on the corner at the bus stop. I'm about to say all that when Natalie's name flashes on the screen. I answer it, a little defeated. Hey, what's going on?
Listen, I need to know, are you going to Frida's for Christmas?
That's where Dad is hosting this year with his girlfriend. I groan. I tried to pretend that isn't happening.
But it is happening, and Lila and I want to know if we should go.
That's her girlfriend. You two should go, I say dryly.
What we're trying to say is we want to go if you're there.
But I want to go to Christian's with Josie, if she'll have me. I don't know if I will be.
What's wrong, Wes?
My sister's the one person who understands me completely, so I say. I had a couple bad games, I was pretty distracted, and at first I thought it was because of Josie.
Wes,
she says kindly.
Do you think maybe the pressure isn't Josie, but Dad?
I don't move. I don't say a word. I stand in the kitchen with a simple and obvious truth. She was never the distraction. You're right, I say to my sister, then end the call, my mind spinning over this revelation. I have to tell Josie right away. Trouble is, I won't be the complication in her life. Not today. Not when she's worked so hard to achieve her dreams. But I can leave her a letter because I finally know what I want to say. I head into her room, grab her notepad of blue paper, and bring it back to the kitchen. I write her a short letter and leave it on the counter. She'll find it when she comes home from work. When I return the notepad to her room, I catch sight of the list sticking out of the blank book. I take one step toward it, then another. It's a tractor beam pulling me closer. I'm so tempted to look. I reach out a hand, my fingers itching. I'm dying to find out what she's crossed off without me. But I stop, close my eyes, and shake it off. Then I open them and I tear myself away from her room, shutting the door. I don't have to see the list to know she's crossed off more items. The question is, how many? I take a yoga class, grab some lunch with the guys, and go to the animal rescue and volunteer. All day I count off the hours till she comes home, till I can apologize, till she finds this letter and I can talk to her and try to figure us out. But the day moves too slowly. The hands on the clock trudge by. I'm convinced her work will never end. Around 4, I wander around the house. It's eerie and dark since it's late December. My footsteps creak on the floorboards, and I'm painfully aware that she's not here. And I'm just waiting. What is wrong with me? In hockey, you don't wait. You do. Spurred by a burst of adrenaline, I run upstairs, change into a nice shirt and jeans, and race to the garage. I can wait outside the library, surprise her with a ride home, be the guy who's leaning against his car, ready to pick up his woman and celebrate her successes. I hightail it to the library with a letter in the passenger seat. I park in the tiny lot. But when 5 o'clock ticks by, she doesn't emerge from the main doors. With nerves strung tight, I march inside looking for her and finding Talia. Hey, is Josie here?
She left early. She had some things to do, Talia says.
And I can't read a thing into her tone, if that's good or bad or if she even knows. I race back outside to the lot, stabbing Josie's name on my phone. She doesn't answer. I pace, dragging a hand roughly through my hair. Where the hell did she go? Home is the obvious answer, so I hop back in the car and return to the house. But she's not there, and she's still not answering. Where are you? Then I remember there's someone who might know. I call Asher and ask him for Maeve's number. Then I ring Josie's friend immediately. The first night I met Josie, she told me she turned on her location tracker for Maeve. Later, she told me that she never turned it off. It amused us too much, she'd said. When Maeve answers, I waste no time. I need to see Josie, now. She's not answering. Do you know where she is? Maeve laughs clear and bright.
As a matter of fact, I do. She's at Dolores Park.
I drive so fast,
to number 8.
Chapter 46. Lovely Night. Josie. This isn't weird at all. That's what I tell myself as I walk into the park solo to dance on a Monday night. Normally, I wouldn't go to any park at night, being a single female and not having a death wish and all. But I picked tonight for a reason. Dolores Park is hosting its tree lighting ceremony. The iconic palm trees on the edge of the park are proud statues, their trunks decorated with white and red lights blinking in spirals, their fronds decked out in flashing pinks, purples, and blues. Crowds fill the park, a motley crew of couples, friends, and young families heading toward a towering Christmas tree in the center of the space where a band plays on a gazebo stage and vendors peddle hot cocoa and candied pecans. Upbeat Christmas tunes and a rock beat reverberate from the stage. Something by Gwen Stefani, I think, a cover of one of her Christmas songs. Nerves skitter up my spine, but I look around, getting my bearings. People are swaying by the stage, and kids are running in circles. Yep, this is the right time. I'll blend in, and besides, so what if I don't? So what if I stand out? It's fine if I look silly as I dance alone, rocking out to Bill Withers' Lovely Day, Greta's non-favorite song. My hand curls tight around my phone, my fingers circling by the playlist at the ready. I clicked it open on my way over. Sure, I'm trying to be spontaneous at times, but you can't take all the prep out of a girl like me. My phone's on Do Not Disturb. I didn't want to be distracted by checking my email for job news. I need to do number 8. I want to do number 8. I settle into a corner 50 or so feet from the street, moving behind a pack of revelers wearing ugly sweaters and nipping sips from silver flasks. I'm wearing jeans and a sweatshirt since I changed after work. Didn't want to draw too much attention in full-on work interview garb. Here goes. With the park lit up at night, I turn on the song in my AirPods. This isn't what I planned with Wes, but after I dance alone, I can fight for him. I can tell him he's wrong, that life is more than work, that he shouldn't focus on just hockey, that he should focus on how to be happy, ideally with me. So I shimmy my hips, I shake my booty, and I mouth the words to the song I've known by heart my whole entire life. As I move to the familiar beat, a memory flashes before me. Days when I danced like this with Greta, carefree and joyful. She danced like she had no stress, and I learned to groove like that from her. The scarf she wore would blow in the breeze, the music would drum in our hearts, and the day would be lovely. Now, as I sway, it doesn't just feel like I'm dancing in the park. It feels like I'm living with no regrets. I get into the groove, blending in with the crowds until I jump. My lungs explode with worry since someone has curled a hand around my shoulder. I spin around, ready to slam a fist into their nose since that's what you do, when I'm standing in front of Wes. He holds up his hands.
I come in peace,
he says. At least those are the words I read on his lips. I hit stop on the song, then yank out my AirPods, my pulse rocketing to the stars in the night sky.
Hi,
he says. Hi, I say, my heart still sprinting.
I came here to find you.
That's clear, but still, I say, you did?
I went to the library to pick you up. You were gone. I went home. You weren't there. I called Maeve, and she told me you were here. I can't let you do this alone.
My skin is tingling, and hope bursts in every cell as he reaches into a pocket and hands me an old iPod. With a set of corded earphones, just like I told him Greta and I used once upon a time, they're so old school and so right. My heart swells, and I'm not even sure what to say except, let me start it over.
Yeah, I'd like that, Josie.
When the song is queued up on the old iPod, I put one earbud in my ear, then offer him the other. He takes it and then curls his hands around my hips, a white wire connecting us as he brings me close and we slow dance in the park. He lifts a hand to my neck, threads fingers through my hair, looks me in the eyes, and smiles, that warm, generous grin that hooked me the night I met him. That's like an arrow through me all over again. We dance on a chilly December night as the park lights up and the city celebrates around us. I don't know what it means that he's here, but I try to live in the moment, and I love this moment. We dance till the song ends. We remove our headphones, and he says,
I wrote a letter for you.
You did?
As soon as you left. I wanted to give it to you when you got back from your interview, but didn't want to ruin your day.
A prick of worry races down my spine. Will it ruin it?
No, at least, I hope not. But then, maybe, since you've pretty much ruined me.
He says, and I gasp. I roll my lips together so I don't shed happy tears before I even begin to read. He takes the letter from his pocket and hands it to me. With eager fingers, I unfold it and read. My breath catches. Warmth cascades down my body. Wes is a man of few written words, but his words hit me in the center of my soul every time.
Dear Josie, you said you thought you were a lot, but I'm a lot too. Why don't we be a lot together instead of apart? XOXO, Wes.
When I look up from the letter, all my emotions climb up inside me, soaring through my body. My heart is beating so fast. Wes, I say, just because it feels good to say his name again like he's precious to me, because he is. He captures my face in his big hands.
For a while there, I thought I was falling in love with you, but it's done. There's no more falling. I am so ridiculously in love with you. It's unreal. You're not a distraction. You put me first and did something huge for me by trying to give me space for my job and what I thought was going on. And I was so, so stupid to let you step away. I'm not going to do that again.
He pauses and swallows, those warm brown eyes so vulnerable.
If you'll have me again.
I throw my arms around him. I'm yours. I drop a quick kiss to his lips, then pull back. And I love you so much, it's kind of ridiculous, too. I don't know what tomorrow will bring. I don't know where I'm going at the start of the new year, but I know I'm with him, no matter what. Chapter 47. Rip It Off. Josie. We barely make it out of his car. The second he turns off the engine, he curls his hand around my sweatshirt and jerks me close. He covers my mouth with his and kisses me like he's gone mad. His fingers slide down my neck, his thumb tracing my collarbone, his mouth owning mine. But my hip is pressing into the console, and that damn steering wheel is in the way, and there's a whole house full of surfaces for us to use. I wrench away, panting. Inside. He seems to blink off the fog of lust, then rasps out,
No.
We barely make it up the stairs to the main level. His hands are on my hips the whole time, and he's kissing the back of my neck. Tingles whoosh down my body with each step. Wes, I warn him, I can't make it up the stairs if you do that.
Good. Let's fuck on the stairs.
And the crying and wailing I'd feel tomorrow in my back would go on my list of regrets. He smacks my ass.
Move faster then, baby.
I hustle up the stairs and tow off my sneakers in record time. The second they're off, and his are too, he hauls me back in his arms in the foyer.
Missed you so much.
It was only 3 days.
Too long.
He mutters, sweeping his hungry lips along the column of my neck. Same here, I murmur, giving in to the way he touches me, how his lips move down my throat, how we're both breathing frantically, how we need each other so much. I rope my arms around his neck. Fuck me now. He pulls back, a wicked grin spreading on his face.
Against the wall.